Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. Peter and Joanne were definitely excited for their world backpacking tour. Although their parents were hesitant due to the violence against tourists in the area, they were most excited to visit Australia. They loved it there, but their trip down under was cut short when they were brutally attacked on the Stuart Highway. Joanne survived, but would she be able to help police track down Peter's killer? This is True Crimecast.
This is True Crimecast, and I'm Jamie, here with my good friend John. We're excited to be back in front of a microphone talking about crime. What's up, bud?
Hey, man. Been a good week. Glad to be back in the studio with you, as always. Football was good this week. Not so much for you, but
you know,
for Bulldog fans, they had a great week.
My Wildcats are really playing with house money at this point. I think they've already exceeded expectations, so it's all gravy, man.
Tennessee had a win that felt like a loss. We beat Charlotte, but only by like 11 points, so whatever.
I didn't know she was even good at football. That's a good victory for Tennessee.
And dad joke.
Yay.
So, Jamie, this has been a really good week on social media. We've had a lot of Patreon views, and some people have joined us this week. So, feeling really good about the podcast, feeling really good about the things that are going on. If you want to help out the show, I think the biggest thing that you could do to help out right now would be to go on to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. We are almost at the 100 mark, and we would really like to surpass that in the next few days. Also, like I mentioned a minute ago, we have a Patreon account. Jamie, why don't you tell them a little bit about that?
There are many different levels you can get involved with the show on Patreon. You can sign up at the minimal level, and you will get a bonus episode every month. The November bonus episode dropped last week, and it was a great show, in my opinion. We had a guest on there, Nate Metz, that does the opening read for us every week, was a co-host with us, and I thought that went really well. There are different levels you can get involved with. The highest level is actually coming on to the show with us. There are intermittent levels there where you can recommend cases, get shout-outs on the show, get autographed photos, and things like that. So go check that out. The money that we get from Patreon, we put right back into the show. We are not going on extravagant vacations with those funds. We are using it to improve the product. So help as you see fit.
Yeah, it's been those episodes are a lot of fun to make. I've listened to them. I think they're a lot of fun to listen to. So check those out. You're only going to get those if you are going to be a Patreon family member with us. So please check those out. Jamie, this is a really interesting case. We're going down under today, so you have done the bulk of the research. Why don't you get us rolling, my friend?
Yeah, John, this was a listener-recommended case coming from Australia, and this is about the disappearance of Peter Falconio. Peter Falconio was born on September 20th in 1972. He actually grew up in England. He was not from Australia, but we'll get to how he ended up there in a few minutes. Had a pretty normal childhood. He was a very ambitious guy. Given where he grew up, most people around there stay in the area, but he was really excited to travel. Peter really wanted to see the world. In 1993, he met Joanne Lees, and they began a romantic relationship. Joanne was born September 25th in 1973. She came from a very, very poor family. And her main goal in life was just to better herself and to do better than her family did and to be able to live a comfortable life. Peter and Joanne moved in together after they'd been dating for about a year, and they started planning to travel the world together. This had always been his dream. This was something that Joanne never imagined she would be able to do. They actually planned a backpacking trip that was really going over a lot of the world, John. They were going to go to Nepal, Singapore, Thailand, Cambodia, Australia, and then end up in New Zealand before heading back to England. It was a very ambitious trip as far as their timeline, but like I said, this was a dream experience for them, and it would be for a lot of people. Their parents were pretty worried about them. Some of these places weren't the safest, and this was really kind of on the heels of the media really breaking the backpacker murders that took place in the late 90s in Australia. So it wasn't pictured at that point as a great travel location and was thought to be a dangerous place to go. So their parents were not pumped about that happening.
They left for this trip on November 15th, 2000. Jamie, it sounds like a fun trip, but it was certainly an ambitious trip. They did have some trouble along the way. After they left Bangkok, Thailand, and ended up in Cambodia, Joanne realized that she had lost her traveler's checks and plane tickets to their next destination. And when they went to the authorities to ask for help, the authorities really gave them a hard time. But thankfully, another traveler overheard some of the problems they were having and paid for the plane tickets back to Bangkok. So even though it was really hard and traumatic in a lot of ways, I'm thankful that they had somebody there looking out for them. They entertained the idea of just going back home to England, but ultimately they decided to go on with the trip, and they headed towards Australia. Now, they settled in Sydney, and they fell in love with the area. They loved the weather. They loved a lot of things about it. They had temporary work visas, so they would work for about 6 months, and then they would have enough money saved up to do some other stuff. Peter worked for a company that installed office furniture, and Joanne worked at a local bookstore.
It was really hard for them to find work in their fields with these travel visas. The visas did limit people to staying in one job for 6 months. So the plan for Peter and Joanne was to spend about 3 months in Sydney and then go ahead and go on their backpacking trip. They were going to go from around Alice Springs, Australia, to Darwin, traveling on a road called the Stuart Highway. They were going to save up money to buy a vehicle to do this with. And that's what a lot of travelers did. They would fly to Australia, save up some money, purchase a Winnebago-type vehicle that they could sleep in, and then venture across the country. Joanne, though, you mentioned that they love Sydney. They thought it was incredibly beautiful, and there was so much fun stuff to do. And Joanne really got kind of really engaged in the nightlife there. She had made a lot of friends, and they ended up staying closer to the six-month mark. It was around 5 months when they were finally ready to go out on this adventure and to go out on this trip. In July of 2001, they bought an orange combi, which is a Volkswagen van with a bed in the back. It has a kitchen inside of it. And it was perfect for the trip across the desert. It only had about 80,000 miles on it. It did have a little rattle to it if you got over 80 miles an hour, which Joanne didn't love. But for the deal that Peter got on it, it was exactly what they were looking for this trip. So they set out for the beginning point of the trip, which was Alice Springs. When they got there, they ran into a little bit of trouble. As it turned out, Peter had been paying resident taxes out of his paycheck while he was installing office furniture instead of non-resident taxes. And he actually owed the Australian government quite a bit of money. It was a bit frustrating for him, but there was a way to pay it back later. So he just said, you know what, I'm going to take care of that later. And they went ahead and took off on their trip. But this had to be weighing on him, John. You're in a foreign country and the government's coming down on you. They'd already had that bad experience in Cambodia, and now Australia saying you have to give us money before you can leave.
On the evening of July 14th, they took off on the next major leg of their trip. So they had a plan, and what they were going to do is they were going to drive for 3 hours, switch drivers, and then drive 3 more hours, and then they were going to stop for the night to both rest. So Peter had rested during Joanne's driving shift. After her shift, they stopped for gas, they got some snacks, and they decided to smoke some pot with each other before Peter started driving. About an hour into the trip, when Peter was driving, they found themselves in the middle of nowhere in an area called Barrow Creek. This was an area that the native aboriginals avoided because they said it had bad spirits. So, I mean, I'm picturing this place as kind of a desolate place. Jamie, do you know anything about this area?
Not a lot. This whole trip really was through the desert, and there were a lot of comments about it. It was a lot colder at night than Joanne and Peter expected it to be. It was still hot during the day. It said that there were so few gas stations that you were encouraged to stop and fill up at every single one because you never knew when you would see another one. So really, it's about as unsafe as you can be and still be on a paved road, from my understanding.
When I'm researching this case, I kind of picture just long road in the middle of nowhere and really nothing around. But, I mean, that could just be completely false, but that's how I picture this place.
That's my understanding.
So while they're on this road, kind of in the middle of nowhere, a white Toyota four-wheel drive truck pulled up behind them and got really close to them before pulling alongside of them. When the four-wheel drive pulled up beside them, the person frantically pointed and asked them to pull over. So they pulled over to see what was happening, and the man that was driving the Toyota got out of his truck, and Peter got out to talk to the guy. Joanne was able to overhear them talking, and the man told Peter that he saw sparks coming out of the exhaust pipe. Peter came back over and reached for his cigarettes and told Joanne that she needed to hit the gas to see if they could figure out how bad this was.
John, I've never known of a vehicle to shoot sparks out of the exhaust pipe. Is that something that I'm just not aware of?
No. So when I'm researching this, I'm thinking, okay, maybe the muffler's dropped down and it's dragging on the road and that could produce sparks. But then to push the gas and get sparks, no, that's just not going to happen. It's kind of a silly thing.
I don't know a ton about cars, so I thought maybe I was the one that was dumb, but maybe he was just trying to do a cheap ploy to pull them over. Joanne hopped over in the driver's seat. She hit the gas, and then she heard a loud bang. Now, at the time, she thought it might have just been the car backfiring, so she was a little startled by it, but she didn't get shocked. She didn't think she was in danger. Then a few seconds later, the man appeared at the driver's side window with a pistol. She said it was an old gun. It was silver with a wooden handle like you would see in a Western film. The man forced her into the passenger side and put some homemade handcuffs on her that had been made out of wire and duct tape. He then forced her out of her vehicle and into his, and that's when she saw his dog. She described the dog as being white, and it was either black or brown, later saying it might have been a blue heeler or something like that. He tried to tape her mouth and tie her legs, but she was really resisting hard, so he let her go and just kind of threw her. She ended up in the back of the vehicle, and she laid there listening to him walk around on the gravel. She didn't know what had happened to Peter or where he was. She started yelling at the man, trying to figure out what he wanted. She was asking if he just wanted their car to take it. Did he want to rape her? Did he want to kill her? Had he already killed Peter? And she's screaming these things at him.
At some point, she could no longer hear his feet on the gravel. She thought this may be a good chance for her to get away. So she jumped out of the vehicle and took off running. And she said that she ran until she just couldn't physically run anymore. When she became so exhausted that she couldn't run anymore, she hid behind a bush or under a bush, and she kind of laid there for a little while. Now, the man, of course, was coming after her. He had a flashlight. She remembers this flashlight being, you know, kind of lighting up the area around her, so she was pretty nervous. She was so afraid. She said that she was out in the middle of the desert and it was so quiet that everything she did sounded incredibly loud. Even the sound of her own breath sounded incredibly loud. Jamie, I mean, man, this is a pretty intense moment. How would you feel if you were her in this situation at this point?
Absolutely hopeless. I mean, you know you're out in the middle of nowhere. It's not like a car is going to come by soon and see you and save you. It's not like there's a business within screaming distance. You've got to feel hopeless. It's just you and him out there, and there are limited places to hide. You're in the desert. It's not like you can run behind a building or you're in a forest where you can get away. There's really nowhere to go. So she has to feel scared to death.
She had, you know, assumed, I guess, that Peter had been shot at this time. You know, she has her hands tied behind her back, and she's running as hard as she can through a very dark place that she's unfamiliar with. I mean, just you can't physically or mentally process everything that she has going on, and then this is where she's at. So she said that while she's laying under the bush, he's shining the flashlight all around. She said that he actually walks by her really close to her at least three times and didn't see her. Eventually, the man went back and got in his truck and started to drive away. Now, Jamie, that's when, if you're going to find any kind of relief mentally at this point, it's going to be in this moment when it seems like he's given up, he's gotten this truck, but unfortunately, what he's done is he's going to move the truck and point the headlights in the direction that she ran off to see if he can find her that way. So that has to be horrifying. You know, you've thought maybe you've outsmarted this guy, you've got away from him, and then now there's headlights pointed in your direction. Just, I can't imagine what she must be going through. He didn't find her. Eventually, he just got tired of searching and took off. Joanne said that she waited for 4 hours out of fear, but eventually went back to the road and flagged somebody down.
This story and the investigation was huge from the get-go. The family she flagged down actually took her to the nearest bar they could find. It was the nearest business. They called the police. The police immediately started gathering footage from all the gas stations in the area. They got a sketch from Joanne based on the man's description that she gave to them. But it took them nearly 8 hours to set up the roadblocks. And that's a big time lapse when you're trying to catch somebody, especially with out in the middle of nowhere. There's a lot of different ways to get away, and you gave them a lot of time to do so. There were so many back roads that even if they had started setting up roadblocks earlier, somebody that was familiar with the area probably still would have been able to get away. There was a lot of work done at the crime scene. They found a full DNA profile from blood on Joanne's shirt. They found a partial DNA profile from her homemade handcuffs and from the steering wheel and gear shift of the combi. And they found a pool of blood that had been covered in dirt. That pool of blood was a DNA match to Peter Falconio. But they never found and still have not found Peter's body. There was talk about doing a massive DNA collection search in Australia. That's something they'd done before. They actually did it for all the taxi drivers in a certain town because they knew that the perpetrator was a taxi driver. And they have actually done so since. But given that this was out in the middle of nowhere and all they knew was that this guy drove a white truck, they felt like this was too wide of a net to cast by trying to get DNA from everyone. So they ended up not going with that method. The police would say that this was like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Not just that, but with a haystack the size of Northern Australia.
Early on, they actually put a lot of pressure on Joanne. She didn't exactly play the role of a victim very well. She actually wore a band t-shirt to one of her first press conferences, and that just kind of rubbed people the wrong way. Do you remember the band? Just off the top of your head?
I don't remember what band it was. If I remember correctly, it was not a band that Americans would be familiar with. But it's my understanding that those are the only clothes that she could come across. It's not like she had access to all of her belongings. So it wasn't like she was doing this to make a statement. That's she was wearing the clothes she had available.
Her story changed about the dog. Her story changed about how she was handcuffed and exactly what the man looked like. She went back to England just a few weeks after the crime, which some people saw as running away. There were actually some witnesses that came forward claiming to have seen Peter in the weeks following this incident. So there was actually a theory going around that Peter had faked his own death and she was in on it somehow. She was treated as a suspect right up until the point where they were able to identify DNA on her shirt. Now, a few months into the investigation, there's really not a whole lot of progress being made. They actually were able to bring in another officer to kind of take over. Her name was Colleen Gwynn. She immediately found several ways the investigators had kind of botched things, including media communication, evidence collection. There was additional evidence that she found at the crime scene that had been missed. Do you know what that was, Jamie?
One piece of it was they found the cap from Joanne's chapstick just to confirm that she had been kind of running through the desert at that point. It was between the point of abduction and where she had been around the bush. We'll get some more of that evidence that was found here in a minute, but that was one of the pieces, but the key stuff we'll get to in a few minutes.
So at that point, they started what was really a nationwide search. They were trying to find a person that fit the profile. They actually had footage from a gas station where the vehicle and a person matching Joanne's sketch were shared. The sketch was distributed on the news. Unfortunately, many joked that this person looked like a third of all the Northern Australian population. So they're trying to find a person who meets the description that Joanne gave. They're also trying to find somebody who matches the description of the vehicle that she gave. They're looking for someone who could have possibly been in the Barrow Creek area on the Stuart Highway on July 14th, 2001. Jamie, they also had a $250,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of this person. There were literally thousands of calls, and it became really difficult to imagine or to manage. Through all those criteria, they were able to narrow it down to 36 different guys.
One man on that list was Bradley Murdoch, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. He was born February 19th, 1958, in Northampton, Australia. He was the surprise third child. He had brothers that were 11 and 14 when he was born, so he was really unexpected. And he got into a lot of trouble as a kid. He got in trouble at school. He was kind of a bully. When he was 12, his family actually left Northampton and moved to Perth to give him a fresh start. So hopefully he could start to work out of the problems he had had as a youngster. One of his older brothers was really sick, and he died from a long-term illness around the time they moved. And at that point, Bradley really fell apart. He started being even more disobedient, getting even more trouble. At the age of 15, he dropped out of school. He started getting involved with biker gangs. He was drinking, using drugs, and started helping the biker gangs to transport drugs. He went on to start his own trucking business. He would transport food and goods all around Australia in his truck. But he also had hidden compartments in his truck, John, where he ran drugs for the biker gangs. Now, mostly this was marijuana and speed, which was also great for him. As a trucker, the speed allowed him to stay awake and to finish his routes. And then the marijuana would bring him down for that so that he could rest when he finally did stop. So it was an interesting combination of the two drugs that supported his work, I guess, in a very unhealthy way, were also the two that he was transporting. He had quite a bit of trouble with the law. In 1980, when he was 21, he received a suspended sentence after he was convicted of hitting a motorcyclist. So he caused death by dangerous driving, was what they called the charge. In 1995, in November, he started a 21-month sentence for the August of 1995 incident where he shot at people who were celebrating an Australian rules football match, and he was released after 15 months out of those 21. But that incident really had larger implications of who he was becoming, John. A little history on Australia. There were laws put in place that that basically stated that the native Aboriginals did not have any claim to the land. So at that point, random businessmen would just claim land and then sell it for really cheap to make some money. And Bradley Murdoch actually bought some of that land. He bought some land that he was going to build a gas station on. He was also a really good mechanic, so he was going to have that fill-in station where he could sell gas and work on cars. Well, at some point, Australia reversed that law, and his land was taken away from him and given back to the natives. So you could see a turn for him where he started behaving in a very racially insensitive way. He had racist tattoos. He really went and targeted one of the native Aboriginal leaders around the time that his business was taken away or his land was taken away. And that's who he shot at after that football game. He just rolled up in front of them and started shooting into their car. So he seems full of hate. He's obviously has the ability to be violent, and he does have a history of being in trouble with the law. Now, none of that automatically makes him a killer, but he, up to this point, has shown signs of being capable of doing so.
After that big incident of the shooting at people, he settled down a little bit, started working as a mechanic, and he was actually very good at it. He would regularly change parts on his car to change its appearance. He did a lot of modifications to his cars. Being able to change the appearance of his car was something that helped him to avoid being identified really easily. In Broome in 1998, he met a man named James Heppy. Now, James and Murdoch became friends. Murdoch started running drugs for him, and they started running drugs together. Hippy gave Murdoch a puppy when his dog died. It was a Dalmatian mix, which was a black and white dog. That dog became Murdoch's shadow and was always near him when he was on the road. Jimmy, there was actually another incident on June 19th, 2001, where a woman stated that Murdoch aggressively approached her vehicle on the Stewart Highway. He got right up on her bumper, and then he cut her off and cut in front of her and pulled her over. Now, she was actually drunk and would later say that she was actually thankful that someone was there to help her get on the road a little safer.
She ended up camping with Murdoch, and he was very nice to her. She mentioned that in their conversation she might want to buy a gun before her next trip, and at that point he pulled out a pistol and fired it into the bush and then offered to sell it to her. This lady's name was Julia McPhail, and her name will come back up again later. When he pulled the gun out and shot it, that really kind of spooked her, so she took off. She describes this gun as silver with a wooden handle, like a gun you would see from a Western. You may have heard that description before. On November 1st of 2001, Murdoch knew that he was a suspect of the murder of Peter Falconio and the kidnapping or abduction of Joanne Lees, and he was actually interviewed by police for this. It said that there wasn't a lot to the interview, but there was really no DNA to test at that point, so they let him go. The police's biggest break in this case came on May 17th, 2002, when James Heppy was arrested for marijuana distribution. Heppy told police that he had seen his friend, Bradley Murdoch, making homemade handcuffs out of wire and duct tape. He had heard him talking about how he could get away with murder and where he would hide a body. He also said that Murdoch was out on the road on July 14, 2001, and that once he returned to Broome, he acted strange for a long time. He said that when Murdoch got back home, he immediately made major modifications to his vehicle and drastically changed his own physical appearance. Now, this caused police to really hone in on Murdoch. He was already one of only 36 people that kind of met the profile. They started observing him. They heard that he and his older brother had had a falling out. So they went to his older brother and asked him for a blood sample to test DNA, to test familial DNA. You can tell that is the person we're looking for related to the person who gave the sample. Now, Murdoch's brother agreed to it. We're not really sure how big the falling out was. We don't know whether he agreed to it because he wanted his brother to get caught or whether he agreed to it because he was actually trying to clear his brother, but it was a match. A direct close relative of Murdoch's brother had the same DNA that was found on the shirt that Joanne was wearing when she was attacked. They had their man. Now all they needed to do was find him. But they were worried that he might go into hiding. With as rural, I guess is the right word, for the Australian desert, like it's out there. There's so many back roads, so many places to hide. There are tons of people who will get in their camper or get in their truck and go out and camp out there and fish out there for weeks. So he could disappear, really, and he knew the terrain very well. On August 22nd of 2002, Bradley Murdoch was actually arrested on unrelated charges. He had kidnapped a former girlfriend of his and her daughter. He had assaulted them. And we would later find out that his plan was to hold them as insurance if the police ever came after him for the Peter Falconio murder. He was tried for the crimes mentioned against his ex-girlfriend and her daughter, but he was actually found not guilty in that case. And at that point, he was charged with the murder of Peter Falconio and the kidnapping of Joanna Lees. And that trial started on October 17th, 2005.
The prosecution had a full DNA match on the T-shirt and a partial DNA match from the handcuffs and from the steering wheel. However, they had to send some of those samples to England to confirm the sample on the handcuffs and the steering wheel. Do you know why they had to send them out of the country at this point?
There were tests that Australia simply didn't have the equipment for at the time, and there were some scientists in England that did have the proper equipment that was able to narrow down the DNA to find the partial matches, but they weren't advanced enough in Australia at the time to find that.
Jamie, they also had gas station camera footage showing Murdoch driving the same in the same area and could have easily been at the crime scene described by Joanne. They had testimony from Julie, and this showed that Murdoch had pulled her over in the very same manner in which he had pulled over Peter in this particular case. They had Joanne's testimony, as well as James Hippie's testimony, giving the reasons why he thought Murdoch could have done it. You know, Murdoch was telling James that, you know, I can make these handcuffs and I can do all this stuff. So James testified to that and let the court know what was going on. Officer Colleen, that we spoke about earlier, had also found a very important and key piece of evidence in Murdoch's belongings at his apartment. It was a hair tie, a ponytail holder, that belonged to Joanne. So why in the world would he have this at his apartment if he wasn't involved in this case? Perhaps one of the most interesting pieces of evidence that we have is when they started pulling gas station footage on television of the suspect, Bradley Murdoch's own father called Bradley to tell him that he had seen him on television. So, I mean, it's a dead giveaway that who we're looking for is Bradley Murdoch, right?
How in the world do they know that? I couldn't find any information about his dad testifying. How do they know that his dad called and said that? I find that amazing that they brought that up at trial, but I'm not sure how you would confirm that in front of the jury.
Did they put Bradley Murdoch's dad on the stand to cross-examine him?
I mean, not that I could find.
I mean, that's the only way I could think of.
Sure.
The defense tried to show that this was all just a big scam. Peter owed a lot of money on taxes, like we mentioned before. And they were saying that this was his way of disappearing. So they actually tried to convince the jury that he was not dead, that he just wanted to avoid paying these taxes. Some people brought up the fact that they may have seen him after all this just a few weeks later with some pretty shady characters. I mean, I don't know how in the world they could actually make people believe that part of it. That sounds a little crazy to me.
They had witnesses that went on the stand and said, I saw someone meeting Peter Falconio's description 2 weeks after this incident.
They actually brought up some inconsistencies that we mentioned with Joanne's statements, claiming that there was no truth to anything she was saying. I mean, Jamie, let's just stop for a minute. I mean, that night that Joanne had went through all this, do you think it's possible that all these traumatic events would lead her to not see and process things as clearly as they actually were? I mean, does that make sense what I'm saying? Like, she may have saw some of this stuff, but it in her memory and recollection because of the trauma may not be 100%, you know, what she was actually seeing.
That's absolutely possible. I mean, we know from all the cases we've covered and from a lot of your work as a social worker that people, memory is a tricky thing, and certain things can cause memories to fade or disappear for a short amount of time, and certain things can cause memories to come back up. I think what the defense was saying here was that she was also in on it and that her story was completely made up, as well as the entire crime scene, and that she knew Peter was alive and that she had made this up just to help convince people that he was dead.
I think this next part's pretty interesting. The defense actually told the jury that they had to discount the DNA evidence because it was improperly stored. Jamie, do you want to tell them how they said it was improperly stored and what they said could have happened here?
This comes up with a lot of cases. I mean, you look at like the Stephen Avery case, that some things they say is that you're in a room and you've got sets of DNA that you're testing. So you have Bradley Murdoch's DNA on this table and you have this other item over here that you're testing for DNA to see if it matches his. And according to the defense, those two samples were stored in the same freezer. So they're saying that the samples from Joanne's shirt were stored in the same freezer with Bradley Murdoch's DNA and that it was contaminated to show that they were both the same DNA.
They actually brought up another point that Murdoch, Joanne, and Peter had all eaten in the same restaurant in Alice Springs. So they theorized that there's a chance that this DNA exchange could have happened in that restaurant. So perhaps Murdoch ate at the table and then later Joanne and Peter ate at that table and exchanged DNA that way. But, I mean, really, Jamie, this was blood DNA that was on her shirt. Do you think that this man would have bled on the table and then picked it up later? I mean, that seems a little far-fetched for me.
That's not a restaurant I would ever want to Eden if people are picking up blood from each other. No, that's a huge reach from the defense there.
They brought up a previously unknown fact that Joanne had been having an affair while she was in Sydney. Jamie, do you know any of the details on that?
Yeah, she had actually, we had mentioned earlier, she loved the nightlife in Sydney, and there was one guy named Nick that she had become particularly close with, and they had had a fling. She said that she would not even describe it as an affair, that Nick saw her as just someone to hook up with, and she kind of evaluated, is this something worth jeopardizing my relationship with Peter? She decided that it wasn't, so she decided to leave with Peter and leave Nick behind. But of course, amongst all these other things, at this point, the defense is trying to damage her character or make her look like a liar. So that's why they're bringing this up, because she never came forward about the affair. So they brought it up on their own. So all the facts were presented. The jury came back with a verdict on December 13th of 2005, and Murdoch was found guilty on all charges with a unanimous verdict. The judge actually said that he fully agreed with the verdict. Murdoch was given a life sentence, and he would be eligible for parole in 28 years, and that would be when he is 74 years old. However, there's a new law in South Australia, John, that was applied to Murdoch, even though that case happened in North Australia, and that law states that if somebody's convicted of murder, they cannot be paroled without a body. So if somebody wants to get out of prison and the body's never been recovered, unless they tell police where the body could be found, they're not getting out. So unless Murdoch tells police or somebody where Peter Falconio's body can be found, he's not going to be eligible for parole when he's 74 years old. Murdoch appealed the decision to the Supreme Court in December of 2006. That was denied after just a month. Then he appealed to the High Court of Australia, and that was denied the next July. There's an author, John, that his name is Keith Allen Noble. He released a book in 2011 called Find Falconio, where he outlines why he thinks Peter is still alive. He actually offers a reward of £25,000, which is about $32,000, to anyone who can find Peter Falconio alive. Now, Noble is an author that's known as a conspiracy theorist, so I don't know how much stock people put in his ideas, but he's not alone in thinking that Peter could still be alive. In April of 2017, the police received a letter stating that Murdoch had cut up Peter's body and given it to someone else to dispose of. They claimed that it had been buried in the remote Australian desert in the western part of Australia. They've not been able to identify how valid that letter was, so we don't really know where the body could be based on that letter. There have long been rumors that Murdoch had planned to finally confess and reveal the location of the body in exchange of being moved to a prison closer to his sick mother. Murdoch has always denied those rumors, said that it wasn't true, and that he cannot tell the police where Peter's body is because he didn't do anything to him. So this is a pretty wild case. It happened in the middle of the Australian desert. There's one witness. There's some physical evidence. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence. Are you satisfied that Bradley Murdoch killed Peter Falconio in this situation, that he's the one that pulled them over and attacked them?
Because of the DNA evidence that we have, I'm really inclined to believe that they've got the right guy in this case. There's evidence, you know, why would he have this girl's ponytail holder in his house? You know, that is something that I just really have a hard time seeing. Why would he still have that one? But if he does have it, why would he have it other than he was there that night and was involved in a, you know, pretty messed up crime? I think that they did find the right guy. I think that this was Murdoch. What do you think?
I feel like we've seen individuals convicted of murder with much less evidence than we have here that we felt pretty good about. I am satisfied with this conviction. I feel like I have no reasonable doubt that somebody else did this or that it wasn't Bradley Murdoch. So I'm satisfied with this, but do you think there's any chance at all that Falconio is still alive, or do you think that's just white noise out there to distract from what really happened?
I mean, did Joanne ever really say that she saw anybody move his body? I mean, did she ever give any...
She never saw the body. She heard the bang of what she thought was a backfire from the car. Ultimately, they believe that was a gunshot. She saw the gun that was pointed at her, so she knows that whoever attacked her, which she says is Murdoch, had a gun that also matched the description of the gun that Julie McPhail gave when Murdoch tried to sell it to her. But she says she never saw Murdoch. She never saw his body lying between the vehicles when she ran away. She was just trying to save her own life. But no, she never saw his dead body anywhere.
Now, they would find a pool of his blood on the highway. Jamie, I don't think that he's alive. I think that he was killed that night by Murdoch. I think Murdoch's probably taken his body and disposed of it somewhere where we may never find his body. But no, I don't think that he's alive anywhere. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I feel like this is a very last-ditch effort by the defense to claim that Murdoch didn't do it. I mean, at this point, they're not even disputing that he was there and attacked Julie. They're disputing that any of it happened at all. I feel like the defense should be arguing, no, it wasn't him. He was elsewhere. No, it wasn't him. This evidence doesn't point to him. But their argument is this didn't happen at all. And that seems like a Hail Mary to me at the end of a game when you know you have no hope. But let's just see if this works. And I think that's what the defense did.
Yeah, I think they were doing what any defense would do to try to throw away the blame from Murdoch. But, I mean, there's just too many pieces of evidence there to really think anything other than Murdoch is guilty for this. I'd like to know what his motive was. You know, that's something I don't think we talk a lot about on this show, because a lot of times it may not be relevant. But was he trying to rob this couple? He didn't do anything to Julie other than try to sell her a gun, right? I mean, he pulled her off the road, but after that, he didn't hurt her in any way. What was he trying to get out of this couple? That's kind of what I would want to know is, I don't see like a long, lengthy history of other crimes like we've talked about with serial killers, but this is a pretty awful crime. Why was he doing this?
That's an excellent question, John. You're right. If he had tried to sexually assault or even to have sex with Julie, or if he had taken anything from their combi, or had he robbed Julie, then it might show us that, yes, this was his motive. I mean, maybe he was hopped up on speed and maybe he had taken some other drugs and he, as we'd seen before, had anger issues. So maybe it was a combination of him just growing into an angry person that needed to feel that kind of power. I mean, if he doesn't get caught in this, maybe we're sitting here talking about a series of murders and he's a serial killer. Maybe he's developing into that as a way to feel power, because he wasn't able to as a child. He was the youngest kid, and his parents moved him around, and then his brother died. So maybe he wants to be in charge and to make other people know he's in charge. That's really the only thing I've got. It doesn't seem like he targeted them for any particular reason. It seemed like a crime of opportunity to me.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I like to figure out why exactly people do the things that they do. Of course, there's no excuse and there's no reason why anybody would want to do this kind of heinous act to these folks. But, you know, at the end of the day, we always ask, was justice served? So what do you think, man?
As much as it could be. You know, a year into this, we used to say, yes, justice was served. The right person was convicted. They were given a maximum sentence. But I don't know, maybe it's just growing numb to this over the course of time. But justice can't be served for a murder. If we do believe that Peter was killed by Bradley Murdoch, then and I think we agree that he was, then I don't know that justice can happen, because nothing's going to bring Peter back. But as much as our legal system allows, we got pretty close.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's very well said, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. But, you know, you can't bring these folks back. You can't undo the past. But I think at the end of the day, you can rest assured knowing that Murdoch is never going to have the opportunity to do this to anyone again. So in that sense, for me, justice has been served, and we know that others are going to be safe from this guy forever.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for listening in. We hope you enjoyed this case. We'd love to hear your feedback. We appreciate the recommendation of this one. This is a case I never heard of, but it was certainly fascinating. Give us a rating and review. Check us out on Patreon, Twitter at True Crime Cast. We'd love to interact with you there. Like us on Facebook. We have a lot of good conversation on our page with listeners about cases. And we appreciate you guys listening in.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media.